Wednesday is the best day of the week. I know how that sounds, coming from a 46-year-old living for a midweek school run. But that's where I am. That's what's left. Every Wednesday evening, I drive the carpool for four kids. My daughter, Ashley, and three of her friends from school. Leia, Craig, and Manny. I pick them up from the after-school club at 4:30, and I drive them home, one by one, door to door, same order every week. Leia first. She lives on the new build estate near the retail park, the one with the identical brick fronts and the tiny driveways. Her mom always waves from the kitchen window. Leia needs dropping off at the top of the drive because their gate sticks and she can't open it from the outside. Then Craig. His house is down a cul-de-sac off of the Burntwood Road. His mom works late on Wednesdays, so his dad answers the door, usually holding a tea towel, looking like he's already burned something. Craig's 10, the youngest of the group, and he talks the entire journey. About football, Minecraft, or whatever YouTube video rewired his brain that morning. He doesn't need encouraging, just needs an audience. Manny is after Craig. Manny is quiet, not shy. There's a difference. Shy kids want to talk, but can't. Manny just doesn't. He sits in the back, behind the passenger seat, hands flat on his knees, watching the road. His dad opens the door, nods at me, and pulls Manny inside. I've never been invited in. Never heard his dad say more than two words. Then, it's just me and Ashley. And that's the part I live for. The route home takes about 40 minutes. It's mostly B roads, ones that snake through semi-rural Staffordshire. Fields, hedgerows, and the occasional farm shop that's never open when you need it. Streetlights thin out after the first 10 minutes. After 20, they're gone entirely. You learn the potholes by memory, which bends tighten halfway through, which stretches flood in November. I know this road the way I know the inside of my own house. It's mine. The forecast had been screaming about snow all day. Amber warning, first proper cold snap of the winter. The news said 6 inches by midnight, possibly more in the north of the country. Travel is not advised. I'd watch the weather on my lunch break, standing in the staff kitchen with a mug going cold in my hand, and I thought about ringing round. I didn't. The other parents have work, the kids have clubs, Craig's mom does a late shift on Wednesdays, Leia's mom drives a delivery route, Manny's dad. Well, I've never really known what Manny's dad does. I just know he needs Manny dropping off, and he needs it done quietly. And I've never cancelled a Wednesday. Not once in 2 years. So, I did what I know how to do. I checked the tyres, topped up the screen wash with the proper winter stuff, the one that doesn't freeze to the wipers. I threw the old picnic blanket into the boot, and a torch, and a spare bottle of water. Because that's what you do. You prepare. You stay ahead of the weather. That's my language. Practicality. I was never much good at anything else. I didn't used to be the carpool dad. Helen did everything that involved actually connecting with another human being. She knew every parent by first name, their jobs, and which ones were going through separations and which had just gotten promoted. She remembered birthdays, brought a cake to the school gate on the last day of term. I did logistics. I made sure the car was serviced. I kept the fuel above half a tank because Helen had a habit of running it to empty and then acting surprised when the warning light came on. That was our balance. Helen handled the architecture of our life, and I handled the infrastructure. When she died, the architecture collapsed, but the infrastructure held. I kept doing what I knew how to do. But I took over the carpool, because someone had to, and I had a suffocating need to feel useful. 2 years of Wednesday evenings. Here's the thing about the carpool. When you're driving, you're not face to face. You're side by side, eyes on the road. And something about that arrangement makes kids talk. Not to you, around you. You become furniture, background, a pair of hands on a steering wheel. And Ashley, who at home communicates exclusively through closed doors and single word answers, becomes someone else in the car. She laughs, teases Leah about a boy in their science class, and argues with Craig about which crisps are best, passionately, pointlessly, the way only 13-year-olds can. She does impressions of their geography teacher that makes Manny's mouth twitch into something almost like a smile. She becomes the version of herself I remember, the version that existed before. I don't interrupt or ask questions. I learned early that any attempt to join the conversation kills it instantly. If I laugh at the wrong moment, she clams up. If I ask a follow-up question, she gives me the look, the one that says you are ruining this by acknowledging it exists. So I drive, I listen, pretend I'm not there, and for 40 minutes every Wednesday, I get my daughter back. I know her seatbelt habits. She loops the shoulder strap behind her back when she thinks I'm not watching. I've told her 3 times not to do this. She's told me 3 times that it digs into her neck. We've reached an unspoken stalemate where she does it, and I pretend I don't see. I know her preferred temperature. I know she gets car sick if she reads her phone on the winding section past Hammerwich, so she always puts it away around the same bend, staring out the window until the road straightens. I know all of this. To me, it meant I knew her. I don't know what music she listens to. I've heard it bleeding through a bedroom door. Nothing I recognize, but I've never asked. I don't know the names of her friends outside this car. She mentions people sometimes. A girl called Jess, a boy called Kai. Names without faces. I nod when she says them, as if I'm keeping track. But I'm not. They vanish the moment she stops speaking. I don't know what she thinks about when she goes quiet, nor what she writes in the notebook she keeps in her bedside drawer. I don't even know if she misses her mom the way I do. Constantly, like a bruise that won't heal. Or if she misses her differently, in a way I can't access because I never learned the language. I don't know any of it. But I know the seatbelt thing, and I know the temperature. That was enough. This particular Wednesday started the same as every other. I pulled up outside the school at 4:30. The snow started as the kids were piling in. Just light flakes at first. Leah and Craig were arguing about something before they'd even shut the door. Something about a supply teacher who mispronounced someone's name. Manny climbed in last, quiet as always, settling into his usual spot behind me. Ashley got in the front, put on a seatbelt, adjusted the temperature to 18. I glanced at her. "All right, love?" "Fine." A response that means stop asking. I pulled out of the school car park, wipers on low, and turned onto the B road. The snow was thickening already. The flakes had stopped drifting and started falling properly, angling across the headlights. The road was still clear, snow not clinging to the road, just melting as soon as it landed. But I could see the fields beginning to turn, the hedgerows catching a dusting that hadn't been there 5 minutes ago. "Mr. Adams?" Leia's voice was half muffled against the window. "Do you think it'll stick?" "Might do. My mum says it never sticks round here." "Your mum's mostly right." Craig launched into something about a video he'd seen. A man in Scotland who'd built an igloo in his back garden. And Leia started arguing about whether you could even call it an igloo if you use the freezer to help make the blocks, and the two of them are off. Proper Wednesday chatter, the kind that turned me into furniture. 20 minutes in, the snow was winning. The wipers were on full and still losing, slabs of wet white building at the base of the windscreen faster than the blades could clear them. Visibility had collapsed to maybe 15 meters beyond the headlights. Past that, the world dissolved into a churning grey-white, the kind that made your eyes tired from trying to see through it. The road was still there. I could feel it under the tires, could see the dim glow of the verge markers whenever the wind eased. But the fields had vanished, so did the sky. Everything had gone soft and wrong at the edges. I kept a 30, both hands on the wheel. Then, the fork didn't come. The Hammerwitch fork. I've taken it every Wednesday for 2 years. The road splits at a crooked oak with a reflector nailed to it, left to Burntwood, right to the villages. You can't miss it. The tree is enormous. But the road didn't split. It just kept going, straight. The snow banking up on either side, the hedgerows visible in quick glimpses between gusts. I'd missed it. That was what I told myself. Snow like this, you miss things. You drive past your own driveway if you're not paying attention. So I turned around, drove back the way we came, slowly this time, watching. Same hedgerows, same cracked tarmac, and the same stretch of road I'd driven 100 times. But there was no reflector, and no fork. The road was the same road, but the geometry was wrong. Like someone had taken a map, found the wrinkle where the junction lived, and smoothed it flat. I picked up my phone from the cradle. Google Maps showed us on the correct route. The little blue pin slid along the road, perfectly aligned. According to the screen, the turn was 200 meters ahead. I drove 200 meters. Fields, hedgerow. Then, nothing. The pin moved, but the road didn't match. "Everything all right, Mr. Adams?" Leia asked from the back. "Fine, love. Think there's a diversion up ahead. Probably roadworks. I'll find another way around." My voice was steady. I was the adult. When you have 4 kids in the car, you don't let them hear the crack. Ashley said nothing. She was watching me, not the road. Her expression hadn't changed since we'd left. That tight, closed look, like she was holding something behind her teeth. I turned down a lane I didn't recognize. Single track, one where you pray nothing comes the other way, because there's nowhere to pull in. The hedgerows pressed close, branches scraping the wing mirrors. Overhead, the trees knitted together, blocking the last of the sky. The headlights carved a tunnel through the dark. And, at the edge of that tunnel, just where the light gave up and the blackness started, something sat in the hedgerow. Low and wide, tucked into the undergrowth like it belonged there. A bin bag, I thought. Maybe a fallen branch or some farmer's discarded fencing. Then, it moved. A slow, fluid repositioning, the way a cat shifts its weight when it notices you've entered the room. Deliberate and unhurried. I only caught it in the periphery. By the time I turned my head, there was nothing. Just hedge. My hands tightened on the wheel. "Mr. Adams?" Leia said. Her voice was different now, smaller. "There's something walking next to the car." I checked the mirror. Hedgerows, and the red glow of my taillights on the tarmac. Nothing else. "There's nothing there, Leia." "It's behind us now," Manny said. I looked at him in the rear view. He hadn't moved, still facing the rear window, hands flat on his knees, that same blank expression. But his voice had a quality of certainty I hadn't heard before. I pressed the accelerator. The engine responded, the car pushing forward, and the lane kept going and going and going. The lane should have reconnected to the main road by now. These lanes always do. They wind for half a mile, maybe less, then spit you back onto a B road. But the lane didn't end. I glanced at the fuel gauge. When we'd left the school, it was sitting at 3/4, comfortable, more than enough. It was just under half now. I'd only been driving for 20 minutes. This wasn't possible. Craig had gone quiet. That told me something was wrong more than anything else. Craig always talked. But he was quiet now, his hands gripping his seatbelt, staring straight ahead at the back of my headrest. Leia had her arms wrapped around herself. She wasn't crying, but she was close. Only Ashley and Manny seemed unsurprised. Ashley sat rigid in the passenger seat, eyes forward. Manny watched the rear window. Two kids on lookout, covering different angles as if they'd rehearsed it. The lane curved, a long, slow bend to the left, the headlights sweeping across the hedgerow. And I saw a pothole, shaped like a kidney bean, with a chunk of tarmac missing from its left edge. I'd clocked it 5 minutes ago when we first turned onto this lane. I'd steered around it. It was ahead of us again. Past it, on the right, a wooden fence post leaned at a broken angle. The same post, the same tuft of grass growing through the split in the wood. We'd been here before. The road had looped back on itself. But I hadn't turned. I'd driven in a straight line, and the lane had bent itself into a circle without me noticing. I stopped the car. Engine running, headlights on. The pothole sat in the beam, exactly where it shouldn't be. And in the hedgerow, the left side now, not where I'd seen it before. Something shifted. That same slow movement, that same unhurried wait. While we were driving, while the lane was folding us back on ourselves, it had moved from one side to the other, closer to the car. The fuel gauge ticked down another notch. Ashley's hand found the door lock, pressed it down, a small, deliberate sound in the silence. "Dad," she said quietly. While trying to move on, the car died. Not the way engines usually go, when the warning lights climb one by one. This was an instant, hard stop. The engine cut, the dashboard went black, the headlights snapped off, and the wipers stopped mid-sweep with a rubber squeak against the glass. The road vanished. Without the headlights, there was nothing. Just a black and white swirl of falling snow, pressing against every window, thickening on the windscreen almost at once. The blades had frozen halfway across. Snow built against the edge of them, a thin white lip, growing. For a moment, nobody moved. I could hear Leia breathing behind me. Quick, shallow breaths, barely controlled. Craig made a small, involuntary sound. The sound you make when the ground drops out from under you. I turned the key. Nothing. I turned it again. The engine groaned, a single weak rotation, like something trying to wake up and failing. The headlights flickered on for half a second. Half a second was enough. The road ahead was dark, snow falling in sheets, and something standing in the middle of it. It wasn't close, 15 meters, maybe more. Right at the edge of where the light reached before it dissolved to black. A shape. My brain reached for the word person, but couldn't get there. It was shaped like a person, the way a scarecrow is shaped like one, only fulfilling the general idea. It was too narrow, too tall. The proportions were off in a way I couldn't pin down in the half second I had. But it landed somewhere deep, somewhere older than thinking. The limbs hung at angles that didn't make sense, jointed wrong, like whatever was inside that shape had been told how a human body worked but had never actually seen one. The lights died, darkness again. The image stayed, burned into my vision, floating against the black. "Mr. Adams?" Leia's voice, barely above a whisper. Wet. She was crying. I could hear her trying to swallow it, trying to keep it quiet, the way kids do when they think making noise will make things worse. "Mr. Adams? What was that?"
"It's okay, Leia."
It wasn't. She knew it wasn't. Craig grabbed Ashley's arm. I heard it rather than saw it. The rustle of fabric, the sharp intake of breath. She didn't say anything. Manny spoke. His voice was flat, almost clinical, like he was reporting the results of an experiment. "It's been following us since the first turn." Silence. "It stays the same distance away, but it's getting closer when the lights are off." The words sat in the car like something solid. Nobody challenged them. No one said, "That's not real," or "Don't be stupid." Because every single one of us knew he was right. Manny had been watching it longer than any of us. He'd been facing the rear window, hands flat on his knees, tracking something none of us had the courage to look at. He'd known the whole time. I tried the ignition again. My hand shook so badly, the key scraped against the barrel before I got it in. The engine didn't even try this time. Just a click. Dead. I sat there, both hands on the wheel, breathing through my nose, because if I opened my mouth, I wasn't sure what would come out. Think, think. "Stay in the car," I said. "Lock the doors, all of them. Don't open them for anything."
"Dad."
"Lock the doors, Ashley." I pulled the handle and stepped outside. The cold hit first. Proper cold now. The kind that clamps onto your face and steals your breath. But the air was wrong in the same way it had been before. It felt thick. It pushed back against me when I moved. A faint resistance on every step, like wading into a current. My lungs had to work harder, pulling in breaths that felt heavier than they should. I could hear the kids inside, the click of the locks engaging, one by one, Leia's muffled crying, Craig whispering something I couldn't make out. I knew, even as I walked to the front of the car, that this was a logistics response. The engine was dead, so I'd check the engine. I propped the bonnet open, took out my phone and turned on the torch. The beam was wrong, thinner than it should have been. The light struggling, like the darkness was pushing back against it the same way the air was pushing back against me. But it was enough to see. Battery, fine. Terminals, clean. Connections, tight. I checked the oil cap, checked the coolant reservoir. Checked everything I knew how to check, which wasn't much, but it was something. It was my hands doing a thing instead of shaking. Everything looked fine. Everything should have been working. The snow landed on the engine block. It melted at first, beading into small grey drops, fizzing quietly against the residual warmth. Then it stopped melting, just sat there, building up in white patches across the metal as the engine cooled to the temperature of the dead air around it. I closed the bonnet and stood in the dark, phone torch pointed at the ground. And I felt it. The full, crushing weight of being the adult in a situation where being an adult meant nothing.
I couldn't fix the car, couldn't call for help, and couldn't drive us out. Every tool I had, competence, reliability, the steady hand on the wheel, was useless. I was standing in the dark with someone else's children, and I had nothing. Then, I heard the tapping, rhythmic and steady, a measured beat like a finger on a desk. It was coming from the car's roof. My whole body locked, the phone torch dipped, the beam swinging across the tarmac, and I forced it back up, aiming at the car. The roof was empty, just metal and a thin layer of accumulating snow. But the tapping continued. I stepped closer. The sound was clearer now, and the direction shifted. It wasn't from above the car, but from the side, the window. Manny. He was pressing his fingers against the glass, a slow, deliberate tap, and he was pointing behind me. Every part of my body told me not to turn around. A voice in my skull, old and deep, said, "Don't look, don't look. If you don't look, it isn't there." I turned around. It was closer. 12 meters, maybe less. I could see it without the torch. That was the worst part. It was slightly lighter than the storm around it, just a different quality of pale. The falling snow curved around it in the air, refusing to touch the shape, finding the ground in a perfect halo on every side. It was taller than I thought, taller than a person. The limbs I'd glimpsed in the half second of headlight were clearer now, arms hanging past where its knees should be, the fingers not curled but extended, pointing downward, each one slightly different in length. The head was tilted, just slightly, the way a dog tilts its head when it hears a frequency it can't place. It wasn't moving, but I knew, with every cell, the kind of certainty that bypasses thought entirely and lives in the marrow, that the moment I looked away, it would close the distance, that every second my eyes weren't on it, it was taking ground. This was what Manny had been doing for the last 40 minutes, staring out of necessity, holding it in place with his gaze, because looking away was what let it move. A 10-year-old boy was doing the only thing that worked, and none of us had noticed. I backed toward the car, slowly, keeping my eyes fixed on the shape through the storm. My hand found the door handle. I pulled it open, dropped into the seat, and slammed it shut. I locked it and sat there. My hands were trembling against the steering wheel, like something humming just beneath the skin. I couldn't stop it. I gripped harder, and it just moved into my arms. I tried the ignition one more time. Muscle memory. Click. Nothing. The silence that followed was the worst kind. Full. 5 people in a dark car, waiting, and no one saying the thing that everyone knew. Leia's crying had stopped, because she'd run out. She sat with her arms wrapped around herself, face turned toward the window. Manny was still watching, and Ashley was looking at me. I could feel it more than see it. She was sitting with her knees drawn up, her back against the door, facing me, waiting for me to do something, to fix it, to be the father, the adult with the plan. "Dad?" Her voice was quiet, something worse than frightened. "You can't fix this the way you fix everything else." The words went through me like cold water. She didn't say it to be cruel. There was no anger in her voice, no satisfaction in being right. She said it the way you say something you've known for a long time, and finally have no reason to keep holding back. And she was right. every single thing I'd done since the road went wrong had been mechanical. The GPS, the detour, the bonnet. Check the connections, wiggle the terminals, try the ignition, try it again, try it again. I'd been running the same program I'd run for 2 years. The one that said, if something breaks, find the broken part and repair it. If you can't repair it, replace it. If you can't replace it, work around it. But this wasn't broken pipes. The road had changed. The fuel was draining. Something was standing 12 meters away, getting closer every time the light died. And the only people in this car who had any sense of what was happening were 4 children I was supposed to be protecting. I sat in the dark. The ignition key hung in the barrel, useless. My daughter sat across from me, waiting. And for the first time in 2 years, maybe longer, I had no next step. The tools I built my life around were not enough. Hours passed, but it dragged. Time stopped being a thing you measured and became a thing you survived, minute by minute, in a dark car filling with cold. The snow kept building. I could feel it more than hear it, the weight of it accumulating on the roof, the windows, settling in layers, burying us slowly. The windscreen was the worst. With the wipers dead mid-sweep, the glass became a white wall within 20 minutes. The interior cooled fast. Without the engine, the heater was dead. The temperature dropped through comfortable, through cold, through the kind of cold that makes your joints ache and your breath turn solid in the air. I retrieved the blanket from the boot inside. I didn't dare get out, risking the cold rushing in and whatever lingered to take action. I gave the blanket to Leia and Craig. My coat went to Manny. He tried to refuse it, shaking his head, but I put it around his shoulders and he stopped arguing. The spare jumper from under my seat I handed to Ashley. She pulled it on without a word. It was mine, too big on her, the sleeves hanging past her hands. Craig fell asleep first. Exhaustion overruled everything. His head drooped against Leia's shoulder, and within minutes, he was gone. Leia sat still, careful not to wake him, the blanket pulled around both of them. Manny was still watching the rear window, but less often now. His eyes would flick to it, hold for a moment, then come back to the interior of the car. He was running out. I could see it. An hour of unbroken vigilance had drained something out of him, and he was rationing what was left. Every time his eyes came back from the window, I checked the mirror. It was closer. A meter, maybe two. But in the snow, I could track it. The clean space around it, that halo where the flakes refused to land. Ashley started talking. She spoke like she was feeding a thread through a needle, testing whether it would hold. A sentence, then silence, another sentence. Mom used to hum when she did the dishes. I said nothing. I used to think it was annoying. She'd do it every night, the same 3 songs. I'd sit at the kitchen table doing homework, and I'd think, why can't she just be quiet? She pulled the sleeves of my jumper over her hands. I'd give anything to hear it now. I felt something shift in my chest, like a door being pushed open against a drift of snow. She used to sit on the bathroom floor with me, Ashley said. When I had nightmares, she wouldn't say anything. She'd just sit there, cross-legged, on the cold tiles, and I'd... The rear window cracked. The sound was like a gunshot in the silence, a sharp, percussive snap, and then the high, crystalline spread of fractures webbing outward from a single point on the glass. Manny threw himself forward, away from the window. Leah screamed, raw, and Craig jerked awake, grabbing her arm, terrified. I spun in my seat. Through the fractured glass, I could see it. It was right behind the car. The halo of untouched ground around it was close enough now that I could have reached it from the boot. The snow fell in curtains around the shape and touched nothing, just a gap in the weather, a space where winter didn't apply. And inside it, something stood that I could see properly for the first time. The head tilted, too high off the ground, the neck stretched to a length that made my eyes want to slide off it, and the fingers hanging at its sides, each one a different length, curled slightly inward at the tips like hooks drying in the air. My mind tried to hold the image. It couldn't. The details slid away the moment I registered them, like trying to read a sentence that rearranges itself between one word and the next. "Nobody move," I whispered. The thing stood behind the glass. The cracks radiated out from the point of impact, center of the rear window, exactly where Manny's head had been. We stared at it, all five of us, every pair of eyes in the car fixed on the shape beyond the glass. It didn't move. Seconds turned into 10, 20. The snow fell around it in silence. Then, the second crack came, deeper. The glass bowed inward, just slightly, just a centimeter. But I saw it flex. The fractures spread further, reaching the edges of the frame, and a thin line of cold air whistled through one of the gaps. Craig whimpered. "Don't look away," Manny said. His voice was raw, scraped. "It moves when you..." A third crack. The glass held, but barely. The entire rear window was a web now, a mosaic of broken pieces somehow clinging to the frame. Through it, the shape was distorted, broken into fragments. A piece of the tilted head here, a too long arm there, but still visible, still close. One more hit, and it would come through. I looked at my daughter. She was pressed back against the passenger door, her face white in the dim grey light that filtered through the snow-caked windows. She'd been mid-sentence when the first crack came, mid-memory, finally opening up about her mother sitting on the bathroom floor. And now she was staring at the rear window with the same expression I imagined I was wearing, the understanding that we were not getting out of this car, and whatever was outside was coming in. I looked at the three kids in the back seat. Leia had both arms around Craig. Manny was wearing my coat, his hands gripping the collar, eyes locked on the broken glass. The rear window creaked, a settling sound, the weight behind it adjusting. There was no escape route, no tool I could pick up that would change what was about to happen. I looked at my daughter again, and I understood what I had to do. I took off my seatbelt. The click was loud in the silence. Ashley turned her head.
"Dad, what are you doing?"
I didn't answer. I leaned across and opened the glove box. Inside, the usual debris. Service receipts, packs of tissues, a biro that had leaked. And at the back, a hazard triangle. Red plastic, reflective strips, the thing you set up behind a breakdown on the hard shoulder. Useless for what was coming. But it was something.
"Dad? Dad?"
Ashley repeated. Behind us, the rear window creaked. A slow settling sound, the weight behind it shifting, testing. I turned to Ashley. I tried to find the words Helen would have used, the right ones, the ones that would land softly and hold firm the way hers always had, warm and exactly enough. I didn't have them, so I used my own. "I'm going to get out of the car. I'm going to draw it away from you. When I'm out, I need you to lock the doors, all of them. Don't open them for anything.
No, Ashley. No, no, Dad, no.
Her voice broke on the last word. Her hand was on my arm, gripping hard, fingers digging through the fabric.
You can't. Please, please don't.
Listen to me.
I can't lose you as well.
6 words. She said them quietly, a fact delivered in the same tone she'd used earlier. You can't fix this the way you fix everything else. It broke me completely. Because I heard it. Not what she said, what she meant. 2 years of closed bedroom doors and single word answers. 2 years of a girl knocking on a wall and a man not answering. She wasn't just afraid of losing me tonight. She was afraid of having never had me. I put my hand on her face. My fingers were cold. Her cheek was cold. I could feel her shaking. Or maybe I was the one shaking, and she was just close enough to feel it. I looked at her. Properly. Not the way I'd been looking at her for 2 years. I looked at her the way Helen used to. Like she was the only thing in the room that mattered. You're not going to lose me, I said. I'm going to draw it off. I'm going to loop back around. I'm going to be fine. She knew I was lying. I knew she knew.
I love you, she said. I should have said it more. I should have said it every day instead of...
The screen buckled more. I was out of time. She sobbed, a single, raw sound that she tried to swallow but couldn't. I looked at the 3 kids in the back seat. Manny was looking at me with an expression I couldn't read at first. Then I could. It was recognition. The quiet, certain recognition of someone who had seen this before. The adult who leaves to protect the children. The silence afterwards. I didn't know what happened in Manny's house, behind that door his father pulled shut every Wednesday evening. I didn't know. And I hadn't asked. But the look on his face told me he understood sacrifice. Look after each other, I said. Keep the doors locked. If a car comes, flag it down. If it doesn't... I swallowed. Wait for daylight. Your parents will find you. Leia nodded. Manny nodded. Craig pressed his face into Leia's shoulder and didn't move. Ashley squeezed my hand one last time, then pulled my hand free. I opened the door. The cold hit like a wall. The snow had piled up the side of the car. I had to push the door hard, carving an arc through the drift, my feet sinking immediately to mid-shin. The air was raw against my face, my neck, my hands. Real cold now. It wasn't the thick, resistant silence from before. Actual winter, the storm still falling, but thinner than it had been. The flakes smaller, more like ice than snow. I stepped out, turned back. Ashley was staring at me through the open door. Her face was streaked. Her hand was on the door lock. I nodded at her. She locked the door. The sound of the mechanism engaging was the loneliest thing I've ever heard. I turned toward the rear of the car. It was there, 5 meters, maybe less, close enough that I could have hit it with a thrown stone. The halo where the snow refused to fall started less than a car's length from the boot. I saw it the way you see something you can't look away from, the way your eyes lock onto a car accident or a wound. Not because you want to, but because your body has decided this is important enough to override every instinct telling you to run. The shape of it, the narrow, wrong frame, the limbs that hung too long, was worse up close. Because up close, you could see the places where it almost worked, with the proportions almost passed for human. The shoulders were nearly right, the stance was nearly right, but the head was tilted at an angle that no neck should allow, and the pale surface of it caught the faint grey light in the way that made it look wet without being wet. It had no face. That was the detail I'd been refusing to hold. Through the glass, through the snow, I'd let my brain fill in features that weren't there. But standing in the open, 5 meters away, there was nothing to fill in. Just a smooth, taut surface pulled tight over a shape that bulged in the wrong places. It tilted its head at me, something that wasn't curious, because curiosity is a human thing. I raised the hazard triangle, reflective strips catching the dim light. A ridiculous thing, a man in a snowdrift holding a bit of plastic at the end of the world. "Hey," I said. My voice came out hoarse, scraped thin, a sound made by a throat that had forgotten how to work. "Hey, look at me." I stepped sideways, away from the car, toward the field. "Look at me." The thing's head followed, a slow, smooth rotation, tracking my movement with no need to rush. I took another step. The snow was deeper off the road, past my knees, immediately dragging at my legs, the cold biting through my trousers. I held the triangle up in front of me like a shield that wasn't a shield. The thing took a step toward me. It moved the way nothing should move. A rearrangement, the limbs shifting, the distance between us closing by a meter without any visible sequence of muscle and bone. My heart was hammering so loud I could feel it in my teeth. Another step, another. Wading now, the snow to my thighs, every movement an effort, the cold sinking through my clothes and into the meat of me. The car was behind me now, 4 meters, 5, the distance growing between me and the only safe place left. The thing followed. It was off the road now too. It moved through winter, the way hot coal moves through frost. It didn't like attention. We'd figured that much out. But it seems that didn't stop it, only slowed it down. Reaching me was inevitable. I thought about Helen, the humming, the thing Ashley had been telling me about. 3 songs every night while she did the dishes. I couldn't remember what the songs were. I'd stood in that kitchen 1,000 times, and I couldn't remember a single one. "I'm sorry," I thought. "I'm sorry I didn't listen to you more. I'm sorry I stood in every doorway you ever opened and watched instead of walking through." The thing took another step, closer. 3 meters. I could hear it now. A sound like cloth being pulled through standing water, rhythmic and patient. 2 meters. I stopped walking. There was nowhere left to go. The snow was past my waist. The car was a dark shape 15 meters behind me, a faint glow from the interior where the kids were pressed together, watching through the windows. This was as far as I went. I held up the triangle defiantly, still with no plan on how to use it. And I waited for whatever was going to happen next. The sky cracked open. A fracture, like the rear window, a thin line splitting the cloud cover directly above me. And through it, light, moonlight, a pale cold wash of it pouring through the gap in the storm like water through a broken dam. It hit the snow, and the snow lit up the whole field, everything suddenly silver white and visible. The thing flinched instinctively, the way something flinches when it's been caught, when it has been operating in the space between seeing and not seeing, and suddenly there is no space left. The moonlight fell on it, and for one frozen moment, it was there, every detail fixed and real and undeniable in the silver light. And then it moved, backward, faster than I'd seen it move all night. The limbs rearranged, the body folded, and it retreated. Not to the dark, because there was no dark anymore. Toward the hedgerow, tree line, whatever margin of shadow the moonlight hadn't reached. The gap in the clouds widened. More light. The storm was thinning. The snow was easing. The flakes smaller. The wind dying to a wheeze. The sky remembering what it looked like underneath. The thing reached the hedgerow. It stopped there, at the edge of the shadow. The moonlight highlighted the snow all the way up to the tree line. And the thing stood in the last strip of dark, the halo around it tight and small. His head tilted back toward me. One more moment. Then it folded itself into the hedgerow and was gone. I stood in the field, waist-deep in snow, the hazard triangle still raised. My arm was shaking so badly, the reflective strips were vibrating, throwing tiny red flickers across the white. The silence was different now. Real silence. The clean silence of a winter night after a storm. I lowered the triangle. Behind me, the car coughed. The engine turned over, then caught. A full, steady rumble. The headlights blazing on, cutting across the field and finding me standing there like a man who'd forgotten how to move. Through the windscreen, I could see Ashley. She'd climbed across to the driver's seat. Her hand was on the key, her face lit up by the dashboard glow, and she was looking at me with an expression I will carry for the rest of my life, the face of someone watching a person come back from a place they weren't supposed to. I waded back through the snow. It took a long time. My legs and hands were numb, and twice I stumbled, went down to my elbows in the drift. But the headlights held me in their beam the whole way, and Ashley watched me through the glass the whole way. When I reached the car, she unlocked the door before I could raise my hand to knock. I couldn't speak. The shaking had moved from my hands into everything. My jaw, my chest, my shoulders. I sat in the seat and shook, and the warmed air from the heater hit my face like something I didn't deserve. Ashley put her arms around me. She held on tight. She didn't say anything, didn't need to. I held her back. Behind us, Leia was crying quietly. Craig was holding her hand. Manny sat in my coat, watching the rear window. There was nothing there now. After a long moment, I wiped my face. I put the car in gear, and I drove. The road ahead was snow-covered, but real. The tires crunched through the fresh drift, finding the tarmac beneath, and the car moved the way a car is supposed to move. 100 meters on, I saw the junction. The signpost was half buried in snow, but the reflective letters caught the headlights. Names I knew, places I'd driven to 1,000 times. The crooked oak at the Hammerwich Fork, its branches heavy with white, the reflector glinting right where it had always been. I took the left turn to Burntwood. The street lights appeared, one after another, lining the road like something welcoming us back. The snow had stopped by the time I reached Leia's house. Her mom was on the doorstep in a coat, phone pressed to her ear, pacing. She saw the headlights and ran before I'd even pulled in. She had Leia out of the car in her arms before the engine stopped ticking. "Where have you been? I've been calling the school. I've been calling the police. I..." "Stuck in the storm," I said. "Took a wrong turn past Hammerwich. Couldn't get through. Had to wait it out." She looked at me. Really looked. Took in my face. My hands still shaking on the wheel. The snow packed my jeans to the thigh. Her mouth opened. A question forming, a look growing on her face that she was putting this all on me.
"Mum."
Leia's voice, quiet but firm.
"Mr. Adams looked after us. It would have been bad otherwise."
Her mum held the question for a moment, then let it drop. She thanked me, Leia looked back once before the door closed. A small nod, quick, just for me. A secret kept. At Craig's, both parents were already at the door, the tea towel forgotten on his dad's shoulder. His mom was already crying. Craig ran up the drive and disappeared into her arms, and his dad came to the car and shook my hand, hard, the grip of a man who'd spent hours imagining the worst. "Thank you," Craig called from the doorway.
"We were safe. Mr. Adams got us through."
I nodded. I couldn't speak. I knew my throat would close the moment I tried. I pulled away before his dad could see my face. Then there was Manny's house. The porch light was off. It was always off. I pulled up. Manny unbuckled his seatbelt slowly. He sat for a moment, hands on his knees, the way I'd seen him sit every Wednesday for 2 years, without ever wondering what it meant. Manny was still wearing my coat. He started to shrug it off. "Keep it," I said. He looked at me. Then he nodded. He opened the door, climbed out, and stopped. Turned back, looked at me through the passenger window.
"Thank you," he said.
Quietly, two words, the most he'd said to me in one breath as a goodbye. His dad opened the front door. Just a nod, then silence. But then something I hadn't seen before. His dad's hand landing on Manny's shoulder as he passed through the door. Not pulling him in, resting there. A small, uncertain weight, like someone remembering a gesture they hadn't used in a long time. The door closed. I sat in the car, staring at that dark porch, and thought about all the things that happened behind doors that people like me never know about. What Manny's father does to keep their lights on, for Manny to be as composed as he was this night. Then, it was just us. Ashley in the passenger seat, my jumper still on. I drove home. The driveway was dark, the porch light off. I'd forgotten to leave it on. I always forgot. I cut the engine, and we sat there.
"You were going to die for us," Ashley said.
I couldn't answer.
"You did that, yet you've barely talked to me in 2 years.
I looked at my daughter. There was no accusation in her voice, just the bewildered, exhausted honesty of someone who had seen something old enough to question, but too young to fully process. "I'm sorry," I said. Small words. They didn't cover any of it. The closed doors, the microwave meals, my emotional absence that became routine. But they were real. And that was all I had. She cried. I cried. We sat in the car in the driveway and cried. And I held her hand, neither of us trying to rationalize the night. The next morning, I got up early. I made breakfast, burned the toast. The eggs were too runny. I scraped the black off over the bin and buttered what was left. Put it on a plate and set it on the table next to a mug of tea that was too strong. Two placemats. Ashley came down. She stopped in the doorway, looked at the table, the two placemats, and something moved across a face that I couldn't name. She sat down. We ate in silence, but it was a different silence. Not the usual closed-off kind. The kind that might, with enough mornings, wear through. I drove to work. The B road was normal, just a road. The snow was already melting into grey slush at the verges, and the Hammerwich Fork was exactly where it had always been, the crooked oak with the reflector. I took it without thinking, but at the edge of my vision, the hedgerows looked different in daylight. Flat, ordinary scenery waiting for the light to go down. I thought about Helen, not the funeral or the paperwork. Her, the humming while she did the dishes, 3 songs every night, and I still couldn't remember what they were. The architecture she'd built that I'd let collapse because I didn't know how to hold the walls alone. I still don't know. But this morning, I sat at the table. At lunch, I picked up my phone. Wednesday was 6 days away. I opened the thread with Ashley. The messages before last night were all logistics. Pickup times, shopping lists, dentist reminders. A man talking through a letterbox to a girl standing on the other side. I typed, "Want to do something this weekend? Doesn't have to be anything. Just us." 3 dots appeared, disappeared, appeared again. "Yeah, I'd like that." I put the phone down. The afternoon sky was grey and low outside the window. Somewhere under it, a stretch of B road wound through the fields where the snow was already thawing and the hedgerows sat flat and patient, scenery waiting for dark. But with the rapport I had with the kids, I don't think they'd mind a detour from now on.